This week, the House of Representatives sued the White House for failing to provide information related to the controversial firings of nine U.S. attorneys in 2006. There's evidence suggesting the nine prosecutors may have been dismissed for political reasons. One of the fired U.S. attorneys was John McKay, who worked in Washington State's Western District. He recently published a legal paper with his firsthand take on the firings called Trainwreck at the Justice Department, an Eyewitness Account, and he joins us today. Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So let's go back to December 7th, 2006, a dark and probably rainy morning in Seattle. No shocker there. You show up at work with, I don't know, you probably had an SBC coffee and a bagel or whatever. What happened that morning?
You've obviously been to Seattle. Well, it was, you know, it really was another day in what had been a five-year career for me in the Department of Justice as United States Attorney. And I received a phone call from my friend, actually, Mike Battle, who had been U.S. attorney in Buffalo. And Mike kind of dropped the bombshell that I was to move on, that the administration, I think he said, wanted to make a change. And, of course, I was aware that all U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president. Mm-hmm. And if the president asked us to move on, we could. But I was also aware that sitting U.S. attorneys were rarely, if ever, asked to leave at a time other than when the president himself left office. That's what made it really unusual.
What was your first thought? Were you flabbergasted to find out you were at his displeasure?
Actually, the interesting thing about this, and I think this is true of all seven U.S. attorneys who got phone calls that morning, was that our friend Mike Battle was not allowed to share any information with us. And we all asked. When I asked Mike, what was this about? What was the reason for this? He told me he couldn't give me any information and that simply the administration wanted a change. And I think that they wanted us to believe, the people above Mike who were instructing him to make this call, wanted us all to believe we'd done something wrong. And we were aware that U.S. attorneys who had been dismissed, and it had happened in a few cases, had actually engaged in wrongdoing. Now, I knew I'd done nothing wrong, and so I paused, and he said, you know, sometimes when you get a call like this, it doesn't mean you did anything wrong. And I waited a second, and I said, wait a minute. I'm not the only one getting this call, am I? And he said, John, I can't give you any information on that. And, of course, later we found that seven of us had been fired on the same day, December 7th.
How much later? When did you find out about the other guys and women?
I began to hear some rumors, but it really didn't matter to me. I really felt it was my duty to resign and to resign quietly if that was what the president wanted. I, of course, was very disappointed, but I kept that to myself, and I made arrangements to leave, and I announced in Seattle that I was leaving for personal reasons. But it's our practice to advise our colleagues that we're leaving office, and, you know, people take other jobs and they leave. And so I sent a very short email to all of the 93 United States attorneys and said I would be returning to the private sector. And I almost immediately got an email from David Iglesias, mm-hmm. the fine, excellent U.S. attorney in New Mexico. And he said, hey, buddy, did you get the same phone call I got? And that was all he said. And so I my eyebrows raised up over the top of my head, I think.
John, had you ever been fired before?
I don't think so. I'm trying to think if I ever got fired from a paper route or something.
Yeah,
no,
caught stealing French fries back in McDonald's days? No? All right. Well, just to let listeners know a little bit about your work as a U.S. attorney, your office convicted the Millennium Bomber who had planned to blow up the LAX airport. You convicted a guy who was plotting to build an Al-Qaeda training camp in Oregon. 3 months before your firing, you received a performance review in which you were described as effective, well-regarded, and a capable leader. So, I mean, it's not like you're futzing around with your Facebook account all day.
Oh, no. And I take that as a huge compliment to the 70 or so assistant United States attorneys and support staff and federal agents in our district in Seattle. They worked very, very hard, and I think they earned that kind of an evaluation. And what you're talking about, of course, was a 3-year evaluation of my office conducted by 27 reviewers and over something like 200 interviews. And so I knew that was very thorough. And of course, that was in the back of my mind. I knew not only had I done nothing wrong, but in fact, my office and my district had just been given the highest possible rating by the Department of Justice.
And I should also say, you're a solid Republican.
Well, I was a solid Republican. And you know, there's an important distinction people should be aware of. I was indeed a Republican, and I had been active in some Republican politics But I'd also served in the Clinton administration. And when I raised my right hand and swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution, as each of the 93 U.S. attorneys did, we put politics behind us, and we took that very, very seriously.
So, John, since that day, we've learned some concrete facts about why the firings occurred. The emails between White House staffers and Justice Department officials have gone public that suggest some of the firings were political in nature. So today, why do you think you were fired?
I think that's a really good question because, as I told you, when I left, I didn't have that information. I wasn't aware that there had been efforts by some at the Department of Justice and probably the White House to inject politics into the work that we do. And I now believe that a number of us were dismissed for political reasons, and I may have been one of them. I think it's very clear that David Iglesias in New Mexico was dismissed because he refused to help the Republican Party in a campaign for a Republican member of Congress in Albuquerque. I'm convinced that Carol Lamb was fired in part because she was aggressively prosecuting some Republican office holders, one of whom is in federal prison today, Duke Cunningham. Mm-hmm. And in my own case in the state of Washington, where we had just had one of the, I believe it was the closest election in the United States in the elections in 2004, and many in the Republican Party in the state of Washington felt that I, as U.S. attorney, should have convened a grand jury and dragged people in front of it until we found out who stole the election. And, of course, I was very aware and was working closely with the FBI, and we all knew that there was no evidence to show that a crime had been committed. And it's obvious that some irrationally thought that I, as the federal prosecutor, should bring innocent people before the grand jury, threaten them with federal prison. And I had, the thought, of course, never crossed my mind. That would have been completely improper, and I didn't do it. But some wanted exactly that to happen.
John, we have to take a break, so please stay with me. In a minute, I want to talk about where you think this crazy lawsuit between the Congress and the White House might be headed. Also coming up, the man behind the funniest street hijinks around, Charlie Todd. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm talking with former U.S. Attorney John McKay about the lawsuit between the House of Representatives and the White House related to the controversial firings of nine U.S. attorneys in 2006. McKay was one of the not-so-lucky nine. John, before the break, we were talking about how you feel you were fired for political reasons for not prosecuting voter fraud. Can you explain how the prosecution of voter fraud would be politically motivated?
Well, you know, in the case of the election in the state of Washington, there was a just widespread belief, I think, among many that the election may have been stolen. And as I indicated to you before the break, we had no evidence of that. And so, in that case, it would be election fraud or election law violations. Voter fraud's a little bit different. That's where people are accused of wrongfully registering people to vote, wrongfully attempting to influence the outcome of an election through individual ballots that have been illegally processed. Often, and most often, comes forward when people are accused of having improperly registered people who are not eligible to vote.
As I understand this, there are those who say that voter fraud doesn't really exist, that it's a claim that's trumped up by people who want voters to have voter ID cards, which would be probably most inclined to disenfranchise like old people and poor people. Is that right?
I think that's the position of many, that there is a, you know, sort of a culture war going on to try to influence in general elections by disenfranchising those who are not currently registered to vote but are eligible. And so I think that there was some interest in making sure that that wasn't happening. And, of course, if it did happen in violation of the law, it should be investigated. I'm not aware of, as U.S. attorney, as the former U.S. attorney in Seattle, I was not aware of any widespread effort to attempt to register illegal persons to vote.
And those persons would be more likely to vote Democratic.
I think that's what people
statistically
say.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think that's what people say. And so, you know, if you looked at it from the culture warrior standpoint, you would expect those on the extreme right to say things like, well, it's not in our interest to register even eligible people to vote from that segment of our society, since statistics show they vote for Democrats. And those on the left, might say, well, we want to register everyone we can. And the dispute has been that some on the left have registered people who are illegal. I have not seen evidence of that, certainly not in the district that I was formerly U.S. attorney. And so to me, it's sort of background music. It's political posturing for the most part.
Do you know of any other cases in which prosecutors were fired for not going after voter fraud?
Yes, I think a very serious case in the Western District of Missouri, Kansas City, where Todd Graves, who was the U.S. attorney there, refused at the request of the Civil Rights Division, of all things, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, brought a number of cases to him, as I understand it, alleging that an organization called ACORN, and I don't recall what that stands for, had illegally registered individuals to vote. And Graves reviewed that evidence and refused to bring that before a federal grand jury. He, as we now know, was among one of the nine. He was fired earlier than I was, but was fired because he did the right thing and said, I'm not going to get involved in that political background music I was just talking about. I'm not going to bring someone who, in my judgment, the evidence does not support as having committed a crime. And he was fired for it. And here's the interesting thing. The person they replaced him with, Bradley Schlossman, who was the deputy in the Civil Rights Division, had come to him to urge him to file those cases. Todd Graves refused. They fired Todd Graves and replaced him with Bradley Schlossman, who then rushed those indictments forward, according to press reports, and managed to get them filed before the election, which, you know, when you look at those facts, they cause the hair to stand up on the back of your neck, because federal prosecutors should not be engaged in the process of attempting to influence local elections, and they certainly should never be involved in advancing indictments against people who are innocent. And what happened in the case was those cases were dismissed by a federal judge, that is so rare and so unusual that before a case moves forward, a judge looks at it and says, this case shouldn't even have been brought before this court. And so Bradley Schlossman was then brought before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. And I think you could see the sweat breaking out on his forehead as he was questioned by Senator Leahy and Senator Schumer.
John, as I mentioned earlier, the House of Representatives this week sued the White House to try to compel testimony about the U.S. attorney firings from Chief of Staff John Bolton and former White House counsel Harriet Myers. What do you think is going to come of this lawsuit?
Well, it's important in one respect in terms of whether the then leadership of the Justice Department, of course, they've all resigned. Alberto Gonzalez is gone. Paul McNulty is gone. Kyle Sampson is gone. Monica Goodling is gone. It's important for accountability purposes to make certain that no one committed a crime in that process. So we have, we think, most of the emails from the Justice Department, but we've never seen the emails from the White House. And the House and Senate Judiciary Committees want those emails. The White House has asserted executive privilege. So it's very interesting because the House of Representatives does have the power to send armed agents, if you will. They're part of the Sergeant at Arms part of the White House. It hasn't been done in many, many years. And I believe the leadership of the House has said it would be unseemly to send agents, you know, to get to arrest Harriet Myers or try to arrest Josh Bolton.
But that would
Josh
be so
Bolton.
Exciting to watch, wouldn't it?
Well, wouldn't it be? It wouldn't be. But it's been, I believe, a number of decades since the House has used that power. So the next step is to go to normally they would go to the Justice Department and say, enforce our subpoena, which was lawfully issued. In this case, the Justice Department, and I think rightly so, I think that's the correct decision for the Justice Department to stay out of this dispute, because in this case, the witness, at least Josh Bolton, is currently the chief of staff to the president of the United States. And so for the Justice Department effectively to sue itself, the third option is what they've done, and that is to file their own lawsuit in district court using the powers that are inherent in the legislative branch to say it is our right to bring these witnesses. And I think the person who's in trouble in that lawsuit is Harriet Myers, because she is no longer in the White House. And I think she should have responded to the subpoena in the first place, perhaps, and said, I can't answer any questions having to do with the president. But she should have responded. And I think she's in a pretty exposed position.
Finally, John, I'd say you know something about justice. So we just wanted to play a little game with you. We call Just or Unjust. I'm going to give you the scenario and you tell me just or unjust. Okay. You ready to play?
Okay.
I think you can do this. Ready? Britain gives us a Spice Girls reunion tour, but we still can't get Guns N' Roses back together. Just or unjust?
Unjust.
I agree. The CBS sitcom Two and a Half Men is coming back while HBO's The Wire is over. Just or unjust?
Very unjust.
And finally, this is a tough one. Pandas born in American zoos are forced to have Chinese names. Just or unjust?
I think that's just.
You're very judicious. John, thank you. Why? Tell me.
I used to be a federal prosecutor. It was my job. I get to teach law now at Seattle University Law School, a very fine Jesuit school in Seattle. And I tell my students that it's good to be a lawyer, that we have a great country, that we don't live in a just world, but that means we strive for justice. And I think that's a good thing.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Faith. Thank you.
John McKay is a former U.S. attorney for Washington State's Western District and current adjunct professor of law at Seattle University.